Section 1. You will hear a conversation between Harry and Andrea, two students who have just finished their final exams. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. Notice that an example has been done for you. This time only, the conversation relating to the example will be played first.
Hi, Andrea. How are you feeling now that exams are over?
It's fantastic to have finished, isn't it? And to sleep in every morning. What about you?
The student is happy to have finished exams, so you circle B. Now, let's begin. Answer the questions as you listen. You will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully to the conversation and answer questions 1 to 5.
Hi, Andrea. How are you feeling now that exams are over?
It's fantastic to have finished, isn't it? And to sleep in every morning. What about you?
Well, I've been catching up on sleep too. But I've got a lot to do before I leave for England. Perhaps you could give me some advice. I've got a lot of things I can't possibly take back with me, but I don't know what to do with them.
Well, it depends on what sort of things they are and whether you're thinking of giving them away or selling them.
Well, almost everything. Furniture, the fridge and other kitchen stuff that I bought from the previous tenant. But the new people have already got what they need, so they're not interested in buying stuff from me. I can't afford to give it away, but I'm not sure how to sell it all. Oh, and there are some clothes and books as well.
Why can't you take them?
The books are really heavy. It's so expensive if you exceed the airline baggage allowance. And the clothes just won't all fit in my suitcase. It's amazing how much stuff I've accumulated since I've been here. Anyway, I don't think I'll need as many summer clothes in England as I have here in Australia.
I see. Well, there are several alternatives. First of all, you could put up notices around the university about the books. You know, on the notice boards in the Student Union building and in the Economics Department. Anywhere second and third year students will see them. People are always keen to buy cheap textbooks.
Okay, what should I say on the notices?
Just put the titles, authors and price you want, your name of course, and maybe put your phone number on those little tear-off tags.
That's a good idea. And what about the furniture?
You could try doing the same thing, but usually students are away all summer, so they don't want to buy furniture now. Another place to try might be a second-hand shop. Someone from the shop will usually come around and give you a free quote, and then you can decide. But you don't usually get much money for that sort of stuff.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10.
Another alternative is to put an advertisement in the Trading Post. Do you know that paper? It comes out every week advertising things people want to sell. You have to pay to put the advert in and then hope people phone. Give them as much information as possible, and if they're interested, invite them to come and have a look. The hard part is agreeing on a price.
No, I haven't seen the Trading Post. But I should have a look at it, and I could advertise the fridge, the microwave, and the furniture. But the kitchen stuff isn't really that good. You know, old cutlery, a few pots and pans, and some plates and things. What shall I do with them?
Well, another option is to donate the kitchen things to a charity shop. You know, like the Salvation Army or St. Vincent de Paul? Why don't you get a second-hand shop to give you a quote first?
Yes, I could do that. Find out how much they'll give me and then decide whether to sell them or give them away. But I've still got the clothes.
A charity shop will take them too, as long as they're in good condition. And even though you don't get any money, at least you know that someone who really deserves some help has benefited.
That's a good point. I'll advertise the expensive stuff, the furniture, and donate the clothes and kitchen stuff. Let's go and buy a trading post and you can help me write the advert.
Well, actually, I'm interested in buying the fridge and the microwave, depending on the price, of course.
Okay, let's see how good you are at bargaining.
That is the end of section one. You have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turn to section two. Section two. You'll hear a guide talking to visitors about a tourist attraction. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 14. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 14. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Roman Baths. My name's Amanda, and I'm your guide for today. Before we begin the tour, I'd like to point out that we have child carriers, free of charge, of course, for those of you with young children, and I can see that there are one or two of you here this morning. It might make things a bit easier for you than using a pushchair. If you don't want to carry your coats and bags around with you, there is a cloakroom behind reception where they'll be quite safe. Also, should anyone want to use the bathroom, there's one here in the reception hall, opposite the ticket office, and another one by the shop where we end our tour, right by the exit. Having mentioned the shop, I should tell you that it's full of interesting things for you to remember your visit by. Posters, postcards, replicas of the Gorgon's head, the Haruspex stone, and the statues that you'll be seeing on your tour. There are also games, books and videos for children and other souvenirs. Our first stop will be the terrace, where you will get your first view of the baths. Now, the statues that line the terrace here are of Roman emperors, governors of Britain, and various military leaders. These aren't from Roman times either. In fact, they were sculpted in 1894, especially for the grand opening of the baths in 1897. But what you can see from here is only a fraction of the whole Roman bath site, which stretches below ground level under the surrounding streets and squares of the town. While we're here on the terrace, getting our first look at the baths, let me fill you in on a bit of the history. This site, with its hot springs, has long been seen as a sacred place, and the first people to build here were the Celts, and the shrine they built was dedicated to the goddess Sulis. Of course, back in those days, they had no way of explaining how hot water came to be bubbling out of the ground, so they believed it to be the work of the gods. When the Romans came, they too built a temple here and dedicated it to their goddess, Minerva. Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 15 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 15 to 20. The bath you can see from here is called the Great Bath. Not very imaginative, I know, but it is the biggest. Impressive, isn't it? At one time, it was housed in a huge vaulted hall 40 metres high, which for many people of the period must have been the largest building they'd ever seen in their lives. The bath itself is 1.6 metres deep, ideal for bathing, and has steps leading down to the water on all sides. The niches or alcoves you can see all around the bath would have had benches and possibly small tables for drinks and snacks. Not a bad way to spend your free time, relax, and tell yourself it's all good for your health. Let's move on to our next stop, the Sacred Spring. This is the heart of the site, where the hot water bubbles up from the ground at a temperature of 46 degrees centigrade. The water comes up from a depth of between roughly 2,500 and 4,500 metres, where geothermal energy raises the water temperature to between 64 degrees and 96 degrees. Over 1 million litres of this hot water rise up here every day, and as well as being hot, the water is rich in minerals, and it was thought it would cure various ailments and illnesses. In fact, people came here from all over the Roman Empire to try out its healing powers. Before we take a look at the changing rooms and saunas, which are known as the East Baths, and the plunge pools and heated rooms of the west part of the bathhouse, we'll pass through the site of the temple and the temple courtyard. Here we are. This temple is one of only two known classical Roman temples in Britain. The other is the Temple of Claudius at Colchester. This temple is said to date from the late 1st century AD, being built between 60 and 70 AD. But the original temple has been knocked about and added to over the centuries, and what you can see here are just bits of the original temple. OK, shall we move on? That is the end of section 2. You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turn to section 3. Section 3. You will hear a conversation between a university tutor and a student about a jobs fair. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 23. Now listen and answer questions 21 to 23.
OK, Fergus, so we've looked at your assignment, which was OK. Now, before you go, you know about the jobs fair that's coming up, don't you?
Yes, it's the week after next, isn't it? The whole week, is that right?
That's right. Monday through to Friday. I'd suggest making sure you get along there on Tuesday and Wednesday. Engineering companies tend to be more prominent then, rather than on Monday or the end of the week.
Yes, I've got the programme for this year, and it looks like those days will be best for me. I'm only in my first year, so I'm not expecting too much from the day. But I've heard you can pick up some valuable ideas for career paths.
Well, you've still got a few years here, I know, but it's never too soon to make a good impression on potential employers. You've got the programme, so do some research. Have a look at company websites so you've got the basis for a good conversation with the people on the stands.
Before you hear more of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 24 to 27. Now listen and answer questions 24 to 27.
Yes, I was looking at one the other day. The boss was being interviewed about their staff development programme, and there are one or two other firms I'm also interested in.
That's good. You've made a start already. Remember to think about what you're going to ask people before you turn up. Not how much you're likely to earn, of course. You only discuss salaries at job interviews. No, questions about the skills you need for the job, the kind of personal qualities employers are looking for, that kind of thing.
Yes, I see what you mean. It's best to go prepared and make the most of the opportunities.
And I'm sure you don't need telling that it's a good idea to dress correctly for the event. You need to give off a professional air.
Well, I won't be buying anything special for the occasion, that's for sure. I've got a suit and tie at my parents', but I don't have time to collect it. I'll make an effort, though. A nice pair of trousers and a jacket. Nothing too formal.
I'm sure you'll look the part. By the way, you'll often find companies have more than one representative. Maybe someone from marketing handing out free gifts, someone who'll explain the interview process, an ex-student who now works for them, that kind of thing. Try and direct your questions towards the best person.
Yes, that's a good idea. I'd certainly be keen to talk to any ex-students that are around.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 28 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 28 to 30.
I'm sure you'll find the whole thing really useful. It's important to go to these events, and we always get great feedback from students who've attended. As long as you go with the right expectations. It's unlikely you'll come away with the promise of a job, of course. It's more about discovering what companies are looking for in potential employees.
Yes. Plus, they're a great opportunity to practice things like networking, meeting new people, talking about yourself and what you do. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely, yes. There will be several high-profile companies in the engineering sector, and you'll have the chance to get to know some useful people. If they give you their card or contact information, make sure you keep it safe. It's a sign they like you and want to keep in touch.
That is the end of section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turn to section 4 on page 75. Test 3, section 4. you will hear Rebecca Bramwell, an artist and illustrator, giving advice on how to get your first job or commission as an artist. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 35. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 35.
I'd like to introduce Rebecca Bramwell, an artist and illustrator who has come along today to talk to you all about getting your first job or commission as an artist. Over to you, Rebecca.
Thank you for inviting me. I remember when I graduated back in 1983, I was very excited about getting my first commission. My degree was in fine art and I'd worked long and hard to get it. I was an enthusiastic student and I never found it difficult to find the incentive to paint. I think as a student you're pushed along by fellow students and tutors and the driving force is there. However, when you leave college, you find yourself saying things like, I'll have one more cup of coffee and then I'll sit down to work. I hate to admit it, but I say it myself. Suddenly, it isn't finding the inspiration or getting the right paper that's a problem. It's you. In my view, there are a number of reasons why this happens. It's a real challenge making a decent living as a new artist. You have to find a market for your work. Often you work freelance and need to take samples or portfolios of your work from place to place. These experiences are common to a lot of professional people. But artists also have to bear their souls to the world, in a way. More than anything, they want praise. If people don't like what they create, then it can be a very emotional and upsetting experience hearing them say this. I began to realise that these problems were preventing me from having a career in art, and so I decided to experiment. I was a painter, but I started to dabble in illustration, drawing pictures for books, cards, and this offered me the opportunity to become more emotionally detached from my work. I was no longer producing images from the heart, but developing images for a specified subject, taking a more practical approach. I began to develop a collection of my illustrations, which I put into a portfolio and started to carry around with me to show prospective clients and employers. But it was still tricky because publishers, for example, want to know that your drawings will reproduce well in a book. But without having had any work published, it's hard to prove this. Having a wonderful portfolio or a collection of original artwork is, of course, a first step. But what most potential clients would like to see is printed artwork, and without this evidence, they tend to hold back still when it comes to offering a contract.
Look at questions 36 to 40. Now answer questions 36 to 40.
Well, I overcame this problem in two ways. And I suppose this is my advice to you on preparing your portfolio of your best work. The first way was by submitting my work for a competition. And the one I chose was for a horoscope design and was sponsored by a top women's magazine. There are a few of these competitions each year, and they offer new illustrators an opportunity to showcase their work. The other approach I took was to design and print some mock-up pages of a book. In other words, I placed some of my illustrations next to some text in order to demonstrate how my work would look when it was printed. Perhaps I was lucky in that I had taken a degree that provided me with all-round creative skills so that I could vary my style and wasn't limited to a certain technique. Now, I think that is important. The art world and many other creative fields do try to pigeonhole people into snug boxes with an accompanying label. Now, I think you should try to resist this if you feel it happening to you. If you don't, you'll find it difficult to have new work accepted if you try to develop your style at a later stage in your career. Nevertheless, when you start out, and particularly when you're going for an interview, it's important not to confuse people by having a lot of different examples in your portfolio. One remedy for this is to separate your work into distinct categories. In my case, I did this by dividing my design-inspired illustrations from my paintings. It's then easier to analyse the market suited to each portfolio, such as magazines, book jackets, CD covers, etc. Working under two names is also useful, as it clarifies the different approaches and offers a distinction between them. I think it's been hard for artists to be recognised in anything other than the pigeonholes that they've been placed in. But luckily, these barriers are slowly being demolished. So I really do wish you all...
That is the end of section 4.